I could have done less all along, I guess. I prided myself on my history appointment. It meant a lot to me here. Whether that's a good attitude or not, I think I'm fairly other-directed as a person. If I was more inner-directed, to use that old Reisman mm-hmm. kind of thing, I might not have cared. But it mattered to me, being in the field of education, that I not only had the title of being in the history department, but that I had easy daily access to those colleagues. There were years when I ate lunch there a lot, because in doing my work, I actually often got more out of my history colleagues than my EPS colleagues, because while I love to be in an interdisciplinary department, when you're conducting research in history, you mm-hmm. want to talk to historians about it. That's not to discount the people who did history in EPS, but I'm just saying, in terms of my relationship to the philosophers and the sociologists sure. and so forth, they were wonderful colleagues, and they were fun to think about policy issues with. Later, and more recently in my career, I get more out of those relationships because I've become more of an educationist and I'm dealing more with policy all the time. And my history, close connections in history have gotten fewer. I'm quite close friends with Paul Boyer. I've been mm-hmm. longtime friends with John Cooper. So these are people I turn to for advice. But the old days of having a bag lunch over there two or three times a week have faded in my life. And that partly has been not a trade-off back to EPS, but because of my activities in the research center in education. So I really had three places, and you can't do three places.
I should announce now that tracking down Carl Kasel is he takes up just about the whole page of K's in one's appointment.
Well, I think I heard that there are people in some offices who are faculty members who are still sharing offices, and that made me feel kind of bad. A lot of joint appointments in history and elsewhere, like Jan van Siena and so forth, have had full offices in history, so that was pretty standard. Juergen and Sterling both had offices in history and in at policy studies, so that wasn't so unusual. And the offices in humanities are, to say the least, not grand. Mm-hmm. But then when I started getting involved with the Soft Money Research Center of the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, having a space there is a temporary deal. I mean, if you have a grant, you get an office, and when you don't have a grant, you don't have an office anymore. So my approach to this, although I'm often kidded about having three offices, my approach to this was to loan my history office back to the history department, because I thought if I lost it and gave it back to them, I'd never get it again. But when I loaned it to them, they were all immensely grateful. They seemed to think, really? We can use your office? So I used to have lecturers just take it for a semester, and I would only keep it out for myself if I was going to have a seminar that was directly on history and not about EPS and so forth and so on. Recently, it must be that space is not quite so tight in there because they haven't been taking me up on the offer. But there was a period for years when just about every semester it was occupied.
Well, I do recall that I had your education office for, I think, a year, or maybe when you were in California.
That could be.
Back in about 10 or 11 years ago. In terms of what department you get paid for, are you 50-50? Or?
No, I'm 75 EPS and 25% history.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that.
And history has benefited from that. I mean, it's partly symbolic, it's partly because this is such a cooperative place, but the rationale for it is the notion that I would teach one course out of four solely in history. Well, that's hardly all they get out of us, because that means that EPS pays for all the courses that were cross-listed mm-hmm. in both departments. So every year I taught History 412, which had 180 students in it, most of whom were signing up under L&S credit, not EPS credit. That was all paid for out of the 75%. I mean, mm-hmm. conceptually it was paid for. Nobody ever labeled the courses with who was paying for them. But the rationale for having budget in the history department was that it allowed you to give a course in the history department that was not cross-listed and was not about education. And therefore, you'd had to. If I was 100% EPS budget, you'd wonder, why is he doing that? Why am I doing that? For instance, when we were trying very hard to keep Catherine Woolard, in our department, who's an anthropologist and had not previously had a joint appointment in anthropology, and was considering going to San Diego, partly for a spouse reason, one of the things we scurried around and did as soon as she said she would be interested in it was to get her some money, a joint appointment, and budget in anthropology. Just the joint appointment wouldn't have done it very well, because what she wanted to do was teach courses in anthropology that didn't have to do with education, but were the right intellectual kind of surroundings for what she did in education. And that it didn't work. She went to San Diego, unfortunately. One of our few people who's left in midstream in EPS over the years, and she was a big loss. But her spousal situation was what drew her to San Diego, and the weather, I suppose. So that's what the function of this was for me, and the same for Sterling and Jürgen. Jürgen would teach courses on, you know, Freud and Wagner and whatever in the history department, and the point was that they would call that the part that was paid for by history. But in the meantime, partly due to John Palmer's great goodwill and his desire to have EPS in a way be the emissaries to the college, the Letters and Science College, he never fussed very much when it turned out we were also paying for all these LNS credits being generated in our cross-listed courses.
Let's talk for a second about John Palmer, because I didn't have that question down here, but as a dean, he was definitely friendly toward EPS. In what ways do you think his deanship helped the department in your years here?
Yeah, well, the going theory in EPS is that John Palmer was the greatest dean that ever was, and that is widely supported beyond EPS. I mean, he was a very popular dean. I don't know, since I was seen as a close supporter and friend of his, whether I would get an accurate reading about him in other departments. And I don't know if people were saying, well, of course they say he's a nice dean and he's helping the department so much. There were times, I think, when John's valuing foundational studies in education and not being able to conceive of a school of education without a strong foundations department, that it probably helped us weather some bad numbers, because we didn't tend to have a lot of PhD minors. We didn't have as good enrollment numbers as some of the departments in the school. They weren't terrible, they just weren't as good as most other people, so we wound up usually looking like 7th or 8th on a list of 10 or something like that. So John's support of the department may have helped us escape budget cuts or reductions or whatever, but I must say the department didn't get a chance to grow very much during all this time. I was chair for 3 years when there was not a search, not one search for any position for 3 years. Well, usually that's what you become a chair to do. I mean, that's what chairdom is all about. It ain't no fun unless you can search for new faculty. So it wasn't as if he was lavishing new positions on us. I think it was at a smaller level when you have these incessant demands to cut budgets and so forth. And on that, I think John just was, you know, he was supportive of us, but not in any crucial way that I know. It's impossible for EPS people to straighten out whether they like him because he was good to EPS or whether they like him because he was a wonderfully good dean. I certainly think he was a wonderfully good dean. He was collegial, he was smart. He listened. I think I've literally escaped any of his famous little temper things. I hear that John blows his stack every once in a while. Even he has told me that, but I just never have had the privilege. And I did some fairly boneheaded things from time to time as a chair. But I know from working with him that he was more than just doing nice things to EPS. I mean, I know that he was a wonderful dean when I was a chair. He was just a wonderful person to work for. He was a wonderful dean when I was the temporary director at the research center. What I mean by wonderful, he was reliable. He always got back to you. He was smart. He could say what values he was operating on. He had fingertip control of stuff. He was a terrific administrator for a school that was doing quite well already. I don't know if he would have been a terrific dean for a school that needed drastic reshaping, you know, kind of tough reorganization and big, hard choices. He was, by and large, he made decisions equitably across departments in hard times. Mm. And there are administrators that say, that's not the way to do it. You got to get tough, you got to make hard choices, and you got to, you know, beat up on the weak people. But our school is not easily amenable to that. It's 10 departments, many of whom, if they're not wildly successful at the high academic game of kind of publishing theoretical articles and so forth, may have huge constituency, very successfully trained students who get good jobs. Maybe they're really into successful consulting relationships. But all these departments are looking out of the university in different ways to different constituencies. And I suppose it would be an interesting experiment to see what would happen if somebody came into the University of Wisconsin School of Education and said, 10 departments? Nonsense. What we need is 6. Let's cut out the following 4. But they would be swimming upstream, to say the least, when the university doesn't run that way. You don't abolish departments around here. And some of the departments have come to the School of Education kind of illogically, because that's just the way we run things. So now we have OT and PT, physical therapy and occupational therapy, because someone needed to administer them, and the medical school people wouldn't do it, and so forth. So you have these kind of funny historical reasons for why we got this very large school of education with some funny things in it. John was very good at running a school like that. You give him OTPT, he's going to be the best dean he can be, and he's going to do the best job he can to make them feel welcome in a school of education. And he's going to be a good trooper for the central administration when they say, John, I know it's illogical. I know you don't want to do this. We've got to ask you to do this. And John, time and time and again, took on more work, more headaches, a bigger responsibility to be a good trooper.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit later on, if we have time at the end of the interview, about now that Palmer is no longer dean and they're searching for their second dean since his retirement, what the future of foundations looks like and the future of the department with all of its new personnel, but we'll get to that a little bit later. I do want you to say, just talk about Herb Clebard for a moment. He's one person that I would we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah. Well, Herb Clebard is much beloved. That's a phrase I think would sort of come quickly to anybody's mouth about Herb Clebard. He's a very good historian. Like Ed Krug, maybe he imbibed some of this from Ed Krug. He will say, I'm not a real historian. And often, because I was trained as an educational historian, he would come to me and say, well, I'm going to do this introduction, a new introduction for the second edition of my book. Of course, he's talking about a book that's a new interpretation of curriculum thinking in the progressive era that's taken its place in the literature, but he will still come and say, I've been thinking about, you know, talking about revisionism. Would you kind of see if I'm on base, see if I'm in the right place? I think over his career, he's gotten more and more active in reading and keeping up with the history of education as a whole field. I think he knows more about it. I think he is more and more the historian he denies being. In the real sense. He always had good instincts and he was always smart, and history is kind of a self-trainable craft anyway. You don't have to be trained in history to do history, but I think he really is much more active in keeping up with the literature now. So he and I have gotten increasingly close about, you know, what do you think about Jeff Merle's book? What do you think about this book, that book? Still, I would, you know, there are limits to that. He's ferreted out the history and gotten to know it about the things that were in the periods he wanted to study and closest to his curriculum history. I've never had a student who took a course with him that didn't love it.
Yeah.
They just love it. I've never had the pleasure of seeing him teach, but everybody just loves it. He's gentle. He listens. He's got really good ideas. So I think he's a master teacher without being flashy.
Yeah. If I can add one phrase, he thinks in the classroom. It's not just something that he does. It's a very conscious effort, thoughtful effort on his part. I've taken several courses from him.
Yeah, he's always awake. Most of us are quite aggressive intellectually, and I don't mean that as a macho male term, but I mean we've gone into academia because we enjoy trying to assert. It's a not quite so nice word as profess, but it is part of what you're doing when you're professing is to assert. And I've seen Herb do something that reminded me almost physically of a much more tough, macho, sometimes biting professor I had who I admired tremendously, Lawrence Stone. And that was the capacity to be right involved in an argument that you had some stake in and then think you might have gotten it wrong. And you go, oh, wait a minute. Could it be? Like, is this all wrong? And then you just kind of scratch your head and stop in midstream. And I think Herb is always capable of that. Yeah. And he has themes like all of us do, and he has hobby horses like all of us do. But he has that capacity to think, wait, maybe we got this thing wrong. He's also famous and spoofs himself for a guy who loves to hang around the hallways and talk a lot. So he's a conversationalist, and everybody has to come to terms with how much they want to talk to Herb. But in his defense, he gets a tremendous amount done. He's probably been on more dissertations than anybody else I know, and he gets it done. He's a good critic and. Yeah. He works. He must work a lot of hours because he also does hang around the halls a lot. He loves to talk, and he loves the department. He's been a huge boon to EPS. Because there again, like Bob Kahle, he's not paid by EPS anything like what he's contributing to EPS. We have a little bit of cash flow problem, workflow problem we're going to face in retirements of that sort because we won't have any piece of any replacement for Herb Clebard or any piece of any replacement for Bob Kahle if there is such a thing. So those people's labors will just be gone. It's not a day anymore when you can count on a slot anyway, even if you own 100% of someone, but certainly if you own a sixth of someone and they're a major force in your department, you can just say goodbye to that. So I hope Herb will stay around. I wouldn't want anybody stay around if they weren't happy. But I think recently he's been happy. He's been very productive. He's published some things in some new areas, not just curriculum history, but social history of feminization of teaching. And then there was some stuff about a little school district someplace. So he's gotten out, branched off into some new areas. He is everybody's favorite person for search committees and difficult committees. He's a good chair of committees. I've been on a lot of things with him. So,
well, one of the things that he was times when he was chair of EPSM, moving on to the next topic here, you gave me my segue. He was department chair when the Joan Roberts case came up, and that was what, about 1974, 75, after you'd been here for...
Yeah, I think it was actually 72, 73, let's see, no.
I would say
it was during the calendar 73, I think, yeah, maybe 73, okay. 74.
Were you involved with that much?
Yeah, I once said that the booby prize for my getting tenure was that the next year I got to be on the executive committee that had to vote on the Joan Roberts case. So I was first year tenured. That meant a lot of things. There was this terrific pressure on all of us. It was a very, very emotional year.
Now, basically, for those listening, the Joan Roberts case is Joan Roberts had been a department member for several years, and she was up for tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And it became pretty much a campus-wide event.
Yeah,
the debates.
She had studied urban education. She wrote a book called The Scene of the Battle, which I had read. I'm not going to characterize on a publicly accessible tape my sort of critique of Joan Roberts or whatever, but I did vote in the negative. You're not required to say these kind of things, but I told Joan the way I voted, and I said people are not required to divulge their vote at all. These are confidential votes, but I think in something this important and we're colleagues, you ought to know what I did and why I did it, because I found out otherwise we wound up having public hearings on this, trying to sort of say reasons about the pros and the cons of this thing, and Joan made them public. So I felt, how can you be in a public meeting and discuss a person's record in public without, you know, kind of saying how you voted? But she had been a student of urban education. She'd come from teachers' college. She was here when I got here. I don't know how many years. I think by the time her tenure was up, she was in her fifth or sixth year, and probably sixth, I guess, because it was probably an up or out year. And since I had been tenured in my third year, I had leapfrogged in a way. On that process, that timing. So I was tenured. Fran Schrag was here and had been tenured, I don't know, maybe the year before I was or something like that. So I think he was on the executive committee. And I remember these things because, of course, these were the cases that were scrutinized to see if they were gender biased, whether the department was promoting males with poorer records than Joan.
This is very much at the beginning of the gender realization,
yes,
period.
That's
the
right.
Mid-70s in the university committee, for example, that's when Women's Studies Department developed, and there was a coming awareness,
yeah,
at this point.
And Joan was one of the earliest ones, and she was the only woman in the department. So we were in the process of failing to recontract. Firing is the popular word for it, but it's to not renew, of course. It's to not renew and to deny tenure to a person who was in on the beginnings of women's studies. I don't know if she was in the beginning of the department of women's studies. I don't recall about that, but she offered one of the first courses in women in education. And she had substantial publications, so the thing was, you know, how could you possibly dismiss a person like that? And I don't really think it's the place for me to go into the pros and cons of it. I do think the public case was one thing, and the private case was that is the case that was before the committee, and properly before the committee, and could not be divulged by the executive committee, meaning all the tenured members of the department. Was one of the things I learned from this is that you're really on the hot seat when somebody comes along and makes a public issue of a tenure case. You can't go out and defend yourself because you can't divulge anything. You can't divulge the basis of your reasoning. You can't divulge why you think it was fair. And that was one of the memories I have of the frustrations of that thing. And I think many people have been through it. And I don't think the general public, and even sometimes your colleagues, don't seem to get it straight. You know, there were colleagues around the campus who are willing to get on the bandwagon about Joan without any knowledge of what the evidence was.
Phil Altbach was one of the department members at the time, who I believe was very pro-Joan Roberts, if I'm not mistaken.
I think he voted for her, yeah. I think he also made his vote public. I'm not saying something about the confidential votes, but I think he was public about his support for her.
I certainly wouldn't know about it unless it was public, and I seem to recall
that. And there were others. Harvey Goldberg in the history department made a lot of noise about it. And so we didn't appreciate some of that stuff. But the worst thing about this, to get away from the merits of the Joan Roberts case, was undergraduates got involved, and there was some scuffling and fair level of violence, certainly what we would call violence, against Jürgen Herbst at the final public meeting about this, when he was mobbed and kicked and kneed and all this stuff out in front of the Union, I think it was Wisconsin Center, where the
Wisconsin Center,
wherever it was, the security police really couldn't do the job and couldn't protect us all as we kind of went off into the night after that meeting. And aside from the fact that I thought that those tactics were that the violence was wrong, morally wrong, what I felt forlorn about was that no one on the campus, not the administration nor any faculty member, came out and supported the department and said, these are faculty members, these are responsibilities of faculty members, no one knows the case, and it is reprehensible that people were beaten for doing their job, whether you like the decision or not. So we were really lonely about that thing. Radio papers were taking editorial stances on this case, and nobody could see the case. And you couldn't defend yourself because you couldn't divulge anything except what the candidate wanted to divulge. So that's a tough one. And we revisited it once fairly recently when Dan Pekarsky was chair, and we declined to offer a Madison plan, that is a free minority appointment from the administration, to a visitor, Guadalupe San Miguel, who was a historian of education. And we had only given him a courtesy home. He was brought to the campus by the La Follette Institute. And none of the other departments, the people that brought him here, were asked. It's not as if the economics department was asked to provide a spot for this guy, since he was a historian of education. And I had been asked to be on the search committee that brought him here. They said, gee, well, you fix it up that EPS can have him as a visitor. And so we said, fine. Temporary, of course, it's a courtesy appointment. But then somebody said, well, why doesn't he become a permanent member of your faculty? So we had to have a committee, and we considered his work and decided not to do that, not to pursue that. And that became a real, reminiscent of the 60s, a real confrontation. There were students who knew nothing about the department who, I believe, were just kind of, told this is an atrocity that's going on, this is anti-Chicano, and you should kind of get on up to that department and raise a ruckus. Nobody was messed up physically, but it was very draining. We were called names, and their basis of their criticism was he can't possibly not be good enough to get an appointment here. He has an appointment tenured at Santa Barbara, and he's written a book. That's that. You guys are a bunch of racists, and it was the same thing. They demanded, and I can understand their moral stance. You hypocrite, you stand there and say you've got good reasons, and then you won't tell me them. So, hooray, white male establishment forever. You can hide behind these phony traditions of yours. But it'd be quite illegal for us to do these by the statutes of the university. It'd be like somebody divulging all the information about a personnel case. So I don't know what lesson I gained from it. All I gained was this painful story.
Well, it's interesting because it's right at the beginning of this period. I remember very clearly the hearings up on Commerce or one of those.
Yeah, there was one in Commerce and then there was one down here. I think there were only two total.
At the time, I didn't think it was very funny, but I kind of took it upon myself to escort Mr. Krug out because there was a lot of pushing and shoving.
Yeah.
And I remember people yelling sexist pig at Mr. Krug, and other epithets would be even worse than that. And here's modest Ed Krug, just kind of taking this all right on the chin. And I couldn't believe the nastiness of the entire situation.
I sat next to a guy whose name I've just forgotten, that's not good on an oral history tape. The guy was in the philosophy department and a joint appointment of ours and had been active at that time, so he took part in that case. He's now retired. I've forgotten his name. And I felt so nervous and anxious about going into that meeting because of all the kind of moral electricity in the air and everything that I was very caved in. My stomach was jittery and all that stuff. And I said to this guy, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. I said, boy, you seem calm about this. It must be young people like me are just not used to it. He said, that's nonsense. He said, I'm shaking in my boots.
So, were there any reverberations from that in the department? Because you guys really took it on the chin.
I think mainly we just recovered. One of the things we did was try strenuously to keep that course alive, to separate the issue of the course and our approval of having a course called Sex, Role, Socialization, and Education. And that pressed us to try hard to recruit Joy Rice from a lecturer position to a permanent position. And since she was a successful counselor around town, marriage counselor, and I don't know what else, but studied a lot of psychological counseling, her husband and her, she wanted to do it on a half-time basis. So that was one very modern 70s style appointment. It was permanent, tenure track, half-time, which I think was brand new at that time. It was approved of by the feds, who were looking into affirmative action because they thought that we were being prejudiced against women because we would have them perpetually as lecturers from year to year and never offer them a tenured position. So this kind of a new animal, this half-time position, half-time tenure track position, was a new thing. And I think that, I don't know if you'd call that a reverberation, but it was, certainly was, there was a lot of strong impetus to do that. Mm-hmm. And Joy Rice has stayed on as a permanent member of the department. Since then, we've had two female staff members who've come and gone for reasons, I think, you know, both family reasons at that point, Vandra Maisman and then Kit Woolard. We've made offers to various women who have not come, and we now have two other women in the department. So we're a little bit better off on gender, but I think Mary Metz has said fairly matter-of-factly that the fact that everybody in the department is somewhere between the center and the left of liberal does not mean that it's not difficult to be a woman in that department. It's just, you know, mostly white males and mostly trained in traditions that were mostly white male. And I've not spent a lot of time having her detail what all that meant, but I can imagine a lot of things it would mean, just habits of mind and phraseology and whatever goes along with sexist assumptions. I don't think, to the bottom of my toes, I don't think that prejudice was involved in either of these decisions I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of time during this recent more San Miguel thing, a lot of chance to try and explain to people who didn't know what the department had tried to do in terms of affirmative action. We had tried to make appointments, we had had searches, we had made offers to people who didn't come. That can get to be a kind of a vicious circle, and that's why I think people were really unhappy when Ruben Donato, our most recent Chicano appointment, came and went. And I don't think he went saying EPS is a bad place or it's a racist place or whatever, but since we had had this affair with the visitor who we didn't invite to a permanent position, we had earlier had a Chicano staff member, Richard Ruiz, who didn't write a word the whole time he was here. You can't make a permanent tenured appointment to someone who's never written a word in print. He was here 8 years. We had 2 extra years on the tenure track for him, and he withdrew from the tenure process. Nonetheless, it is around and about in the Chicano community that it's a tough place to be in educational policy studies. So it's really hard to reverse. And so we were all really pained when Ruben seemed to like it here, and we were really promoting mentorship and trying to make him feel comfortable. And he got a job that I think was perfectly logical for him to take. At Colorado, there was a very well-developed Chicano studies program, where ours here has been floundering and struggling all the time. There was a Native American program that was thriving at Colorado. So what would be the, why should we think it was some terrible reflection on us that he left? The problem is that I think the department needs to attract and retain at the permanent level some minority staff, because the values are there. The normal commitment in that department is very strong toward affirmative action, with the usual Wisconsin caveat, which is the quality has got to be there. You just got to try hard enough to get a person who will meet the standards here. But given that as a criterion, people are really eager to have minority colleagues and more women in the department.
Well, I could certainly see the opportunity for that coming up as more of the faculty retires.
Yeah, how many appointments we'll be able to make, I don't know. But for years we made none, as I said to you, and then for some years after I was chair, there were none. And then we made, within a space of 2 years, 3 appointments at the assistant professor level. We went from having no assistant professors to having 3, all minority. Stacy Lee, who's Chinese American, and Michael Fultz, who's African American, and Ruben Donato, who came and went. So that was a tremendous breath of fresh air to the department, and people were really working hard to mentor those people and hope that they will get tenure. But it will be a real blow to the department if not only Ruben leaves, but Michael and Stacy don't get tenure. So
on the question sheet, I wanted to talk about some of the new people, and you've already mentioned the one who came and left. What about the other two minorities that you just mentioned, First and the
Asian American?
Yeah, Fulton, Stacy Lee.
Fulton,
yeah.
Stacy Lee. Are they up for tenure? Is there a question about
Fulton's coming up this year. He has to have all his stuff finished and done in March, and I've been actually designated his actual mentor, so I've spent a lot of time with him. He's a very wonderful scholar. If he doesn't make it, it won't be a case of the good teacher and the scholar who didn't, you know, publish anything. It's that the volume is not as much as you usually expect for a historian. It's a bad place on a public or oral history tape to make any predictions, but the support for him in the department is universal. Everybody wants him to make it. There's been no environment of indecision in the department at all. I can't say whether the department will, you know, vote unanimously to put him up to the through the dean to the divisional. The case that would have to be made, and I expect to be made for Michael, would be the work is of excellent quality and it portends a successful program of research. But it's going to be getting a historian tenure on 5 or 6 articles. Mm-hmm. That'll be pretty unusual. But they're on quite a range of topics and published in good places. So we've all been cheerleading and mentoring and counseling and hoping and all that kind of stuff, and Michael's been working hard to do it.
He seems like he would want to stay here.
Well, I think he would like to stay here and get tenure. I've never heard him say anything to suggest that he's looking to go elsewhere. He had lived all of his life on one coast or the other before he came here, but he's a real family man. He seems to like Madison and so forth. So I don't know. You can't tell. Of course, from chewing our fingers all the way down to the knuckle that he won't get tenure, then if he does get tenure, we'll turn around and it'll be a world in which he'll have offers all over the place. A tenured African-American historian of education, you know, he would be attractive. But I haven't thought about that. I don't have any wisdom on that, whether he would leave. I guess my attitude has been, we are well served if he's here for the time. And EPS needs to promote and have his colleagues a more diverse crowd, but we need to do it within the standards of the university, and so I just hope it'll add up to that. So he's a wonderful guy, and the argument won't be that because he's black he should get an appointment. The argument will be because of the life he has lived and the interests and insights he has had from being an African American, he brings to the department not only the role model of a senior minority professor if he was tenured, and he's already brought students of color to the department. That's not an advertisement for tenure. That's not a quality thing. That's an audience thing. The advertisement for quality is that he knows a huge amount about the history of African Americans, which nobody else in the department knows, certainly not me, and I know as much about it as anybody does in the department. He knows it much more deeply than I do. But perhaps more importantly, because you can just say, well, everybody's got a specialty, why should that be privileged? He knows about the whole area that Vern Halbrick is leaving and probably wasn't totally up to date on anyway. I mean, Michael brings in a vast knowledge of the latest stuff on the underclass and on urban politics and on urban policy and on social science about cities. So I would argue that you can't separate teaching and scholarship in this character, and that he's got very good teaching reviews even though he's very demanding. I thought there's too much good here to say, sorry, 5 articles isn't enough. But I'm trying to make a case for him because I'm his mentor and we're about to prepare the case, and I agreed that even if, when I went down to Chicago, that I would contribute to it. So I'm acting partisan on an issue that, you know, the average faculty member is supposed to sit back and look for the reports and make judgments about it, but I'm already committed. So.
A brief word about your other assistant professor.
Stacy Lee, I don't know as well. She's got a little bit more time. She works on very interesting stuff, which is Asian Americans' experiences in American high schools, and she did her work on a Philadelphia high school, and she came out of Penn and taught briefly, I think, at Vassar. She's a real nice person, and I don't know, you know, a whole lot more about her than that, except I rented my house to her one semester. She's an excellent tenant. it's not my area. She's being mentored mainly by I think her methodology is closest to Mary Metz. She does ethnographic style stuff. But I think Mike Olnick has also been very involved, and that's a heck of a good team of senior colleagues. And they're just as supportive of her as the historians are of Michael Fultz.
One more question in this area.
as we were talking about earlier, the Joan Roberts case, a lot of the Women's Studies Department developed the African American Studies Department. The consciousness of campus members began to raise upwards in the mid-70s and into the 80s. In 1988, we got a new chancellor who certainly brought those values with her, Donna Shalala. From her position as chancellor, how did she, or did she, directly impact on EPS and on the history department in terms of raising the awareness or pressing the issue of minority and women enrollment on campus? In your perception?
It's hard to say about history, because history has such a wide range of faculty opinion on these matters, and Shalala's position tended to get people to react politically one way or another. I mean, she brought a liberal agenda and did it in an assertive way. I don't mean that she talked assertively. I mean that as chancellor she said, look, you've got a university that has some things that need to be done that aren't going to be done by the decentralized structure you have here. There's almost no policy being made out of Bascom Hall. I mean, there's official representatives here, and they represent the university in the system and at the legislature, but they don't have the resources to tackle problems like minority hiring or the instruction improvement of undergraduate instruction and so forth. Those things have all been decentralized to colleges. And that's not Shalala's style. She doesn't come into a place to watch everybody else do what they want to do about the major problems of the institution. So I could be wrong about the actual numbers, but I think what she did was call her deans together when she sort of got her feet under her here and was confident of, that she knew what she was doing, and said, look, Bascom Hall's taking about 5% of your budgets now. We're going to take 10. Get used to it, you know. And the reason we're going to do that is we have these priorities. They are minority hiring, and the Madison plan, mm-hmm. minority student and faculty, recruitment and retention, and all the other things that went along with the Madison plan. And that was priority, you know, that was major goal one, and major goal number two was the improvement of undergraduate instruction, and major goal three was retaining and attracting new faculty in what we then imagined was going to be this terrific competition for new faculty. It was going to be a seller's market. It was this weird fantasy that was around 5 or 6 years ago that this huge cohort would be all retiring and we'd all be fighting over the new quality professors. So that turned out to be wrong. But a lot of universities were worried at that time, what are you going to do when your current core of so many senior mm-hmm. people retires, how are you going to keep?
Post World War II.
The people that are
who came
the big expansion of the '60s, and it's true of EPS, as you know. You can see there's a very large group of yes. people who are now between 63 and 66 or 7. It turned out not to be the case nationally because people retired and they weren't replaced. Mm-hmm. It turns out all the publics and all the privates were broke at the same time. So the poor generation of people thought that they were getting their PhDs just at the right time got a surprise. So Shalala, did things like the Madison Plan, where she said it's important to the future of this university that we have more diversity in our faculty. And we won't get them until the 23rd century if we say, but we can only hire in the slots where we decide we have needs, because it's a very highly specialized place. And to say, well, we want people of color and we want more women. But, of course, the first thing is you have to decide whether you need the 5th century Japanese language course or the high energy computerized this and that course. She said, well, what we're going to do is this, we're going to take some money and say it's for minority hires, it's for targets of opportunity, and it's going to be whether we need the person or not, but the quality's got to be there. So that was the policy of the Madison plan, and that money has to come from somewhere. We hired Michael Fultz even though we did not need a historian of education. We hired him on the Madison plan because the quality was there, and because he would bring us, as I tried to express before, things we really needed, but you couldn't argue that we needed a historian of education. We needed someone to bring us knowledge of what it's like to live in big cities and what the research says about it now and stuff like that.
You said you weren't necessarily looking for a history of ed person. Did you just kind of look out there generally and educate in the educational policy?
We had systematically looked. We had pressured EPS faculty to think about minorities that might be possible target of opportunity hires, where you were allowed to go out and not conduct a general search and not have it be a competition, but simply invite the person to come, which was now allowed not only by Shalala's policy, but by court decisions, which I feel very ambivalent about because they run counter to what we thought was liberalism in the 60s, which says every fight will be a fair fight, every fight will be open and be open to all people regardless of race and so forth. But various court decisions said, again, you won't fix this situation. You won't remedy the wrong doing that. You'll only remedy the wrong if in the short run you're allowed to do these target of opportunity things. So various courts said that they were legal. And so I sort of, you know, figured, well, I'll be instructed by my betters and my people who know the law better than I do. So given that situation, a lot of EPS people thought hard about senior people, junior people, people of color, and we had some searches in which they were candidates that were open searches and where we made offers. Michael Fultz was in the second or third year of that EPS effort to identify possible people, and I found him because I interviewed for a job at Harvard, and there he was. He would have been one of my colleagues there, and I got to know him a little bit. When I decided not to go to Harvard in that episode, I called up the dean who had tried to hire me there, who's an old friend and a historian of education, Pat Graham, who had been wonderfully good about my not going there. I was the only person she said during her deanship they'd made an offer to who hadn't come. And Harvard traditionally has not been friendly to people who get offers and then don't come. They don't like to be told that. Pat was wonderful and friendly. She was as professional as she could be about it, at the same time maintaining our friendship. So I called her up the next year and I said, Pat, I'm going fishing in your own pond. I'm going to talk to Michael Fultz about whether he might want to come out here. And she said, fine, that's academia. We'll do everything we can to keep him. But he wasn't really in a tenure track position. He was an instructor and he was getting exploited a little bit, not intentionally by Pat, but he was on a half-time schedule and being paid half-time. And he's such a, you know, straight arrow. He was overworking his time and so forth. And he said he came out here just to boost this idea that we were really the center for history of education. He said he came out here because he wanted to have more close colleagues to work with that he would learn from as an assistant professor about the history of education, which was not happening at Harvard, partly because the only one left in the history of education there was Pat Graham, and she was the dean, so she was just real busy. They're very good friends, and he does think of her as a mentor, but to my great delight, he came, and he's a good example of what the Madison Plan could do for this campus. But conservative professors were quite right. It wasn't some magic that produced these positions. It was not doing other positions under the old slot system. So for every Michael Fultz that came, somebody's specialty, somebody's, you know, idea of a desperately needed academic area didn't get to have their slot. So it's just a choice. It's a policy choice.
Yeah, is that going to be a positive or a negative impact?
I don't know if Shalala's exact words were on the topic of why you need minorities, but I remember going to my daughter's graduation at Yale in 1992. Is that right? 91 or 92. And Calvin Trillin, the humorist, was there. He's a member of the Yale Board of Trustees, and he gave a talk at class day or whatever it was called, not at the actual ceremony of graduation but the day before, and he said he went to Yale in the 1950s, and he was talking about the 50s when he was there, and he said, if the demography of your class at Yale College was today what mine was when I was here in the 50s, it would no longer be a first-rate institution. And the kids all applauded and stood up and stuff because they had gone through a lot. There had been racial strife and, you know, separatism and all this stuff. And they said, to tell somebody, nice going, you're diverse, you didn't have any choice, you wouldn't be Yale University unless you were more diverse, I think was the spirit of what Shalala brought to this place. It's a national institution, and it has to have a more diverse faculty and student body or it won't be a world-class institution 20 years from now.
Is that her legacy?
I don't know. I think the issue is still in doubt. It's an uphill battle to get and retain minority faculty here because it's just, you know what she said, I was director of the research center when she came, so there was one night when they had an evening with her getting to know people around the university. One of them was based on all the people who were associate deans for research. I don't know why, who dreamed that up, but it was a very nice affair. It was at the Madison Club, and spouses came, and we got a chance to see this flashy new chancellor before she came, and it was that fall semester when she hadn't taken office yet. So we went, and she gave a talk, and there were computer people there complaining about the computer center. You know, there's all kinds of interests around here, and you can talk research, but I believe it was my wife who said, talk a little bit about affirmative action. What are you going to do about it, and how are you going to pull it off? How are you going to get people to come to Madison and stay? It's like a vicious circle. Mm-hmm. People come, and it's such a white world that they're not comfortable, or their families are not comfortable, and how do you create that? And my own metaphor for this is the trick is how do you get from 2% to 10%? Because if you think it's a great achievement to get from 2% to 4%, you won't have done anything, because it won't change the look of the place, and it won't change the culture of the place, and you'll just lose it again. You got to get really far, really fast, then you will have done, you're over the hump. I don't think we're over the hump. I don't think we got there. I don't know what the percentage of minority faculty is. It's better than when she came, I think. But we have all kinds of disappointing statistics from year to year on retention of minority students and retention of minority faculty. Her metaphor was also useful. She was touted as a sports hero when she came. Remember, she was a really competitive tennis player, and she was said to climb the Himalayas and all that stuff. I think actually she goes walking in Nepal, but I'm not sure it's on the Himalayas. But she is an athlete, and she used the metaphor that night. She said, when my wife said, how are you going to do this? Because there is this vicious circle problem. She said, full court press. She said, the university needs to make real connections with traditionally black institutions. It needs to set up recruiting networks with predominantly black secondary schools. It needs to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It needs to get sources of funding for minority students. I think she's really tried hard to do a lot of that, and I think Ward is committed to the same stuff. I just don't know what we're going to look like in 10 years or 20 years.
That was my next question. Is David Ward committed along the same lines as Dunn?
Yeah, I haven't been as involved. I decided 3 or 4 years ago to retreat somewhat from faculty governance. There was a time when I was really seeing a lot of these folks and talking a lot about it, so I wouldn't be as well informed on David. I'm a real fan of David's, but I don't know the numbers on how they're doing on minority students and retention and all that kind of stuff, so I don't know. I knew him best, well, I mean, I knew about his views on these matters a lot when he was provost for Shalala, and I knew he was very strongly committed to her program of affirmative action, although she got tagged with it as being the outsider who came in. Partly it's because she came into a racial crisis that wasn't of her own making. Mm-hmm. I was with her in Chicago at a meeting the day she was called up by Mary Rouse and said, there's been this slave sale at this fraternity, you know, or whichever one was that, or the Fiji picture or something. It was after they had already been negotiating with these kids, and her first reaction was real anger. Kind of fuming about stuff like those, you know, rednecks, we ought to put them out of business or something. That was an exact quote, but that was the sentiment, you know. And she immediately, just in the car on the way back, got back into gear after her just being angry about this eruption of racism, and said, well, of course you can't shut them down, you can't do that, and this may not be the right thing to do anyway. It's a university run by its faculty, we'll have to have a commission, and so forth, and that became the Commission on the Fraternities, run by Jim, what's his name, the guy from the journalism school, I've forgotten his last name right now, faculty member.
Brown?
No, that's not it, I forgot his name. Anyway, he's in the journalism school, and they did what, you know, you could say it's a compromise, but maybe that's the way we do things, and maybe it's the right way to do things. They injected resident people into these fraternities to kind of, you know, monitor what they were doing, and they suspended some of them for a while and all that kind of stuff. So it was something short of the university disaffiliating itself with the fraternities. And some people would argue you don't gain much by doing that. They just continue to exist outside your own reach, and then you'll have no influence over them. But anyway, I think she was affiliated with that kind of program more strongly than Ward was, but he certainly agreed with it when he was provost. I don't know what's going on now.
Yeah, she seemed always to be a very impatient person in sort of a very patient world. The university moves at a much...
Impatient's a good word for her, but I was on the University Academic Planning Council, and I also knew her before she came, very slightly, but that's because of Lawrence Kremen. I trained for a year with Kremen and kept in touch with him. And she had her first teaching job after she got her doctorate degree at the Maxwell School in Syracuse in the politics of education. She had her first job teaching politics of education at Teachers College, where Kremen was the president. So he was her first boss. And they had been, he had been a mentor to her and a mentor to me. So, and I'd never met her, and I'd heard her name over the years. We were both, I forgot what they were called, but kind of junior fellows in the National Academy of Education. She used to flatter me by saying we were fellows and all that stuff. But I never met her in that thing. And so when she was appointed chancellor here, I had never met her. The Kremen said, oh, well, Kaysel, he's really active in faculty governance. So you ought to rely on him, all that stuff. Well, she didn't know that many faculty members. So I was program chair of the National Academy of Education meetings that year, and I asked her to come out to Los Angeles and give a talk. She was actually supposed to react to some papers on desegregation, and darn if she didn't come. And so that was the first time I met her, the fall before she was going to come here. And so I said, oh, no, I'm not. There are many faculty members much more active than I am, because she said, tell me about the TAA, tell me about this, tell me about that. It was a wonderful way to meet her, because she wasn't holding court yet. I mean, she wasn't in charge. People at the meeting didn't know who she was particularly. It was all these high mucky mucks here in the National Education Academy. So she was just a new member. And so we had a chance to sit over on a bench for a while in UCLA in a lounge and talk for 45, 50 minutes about all these things she wanted to know about. But I kept saying, I'm not that active. Well, then she got here, and I was on the University Academic Planning Council, and I was the interim director of the research center. And so she said, seems like he's active. So that was a lot of fun. I really grooved on that. I enjoyed watching her, because I was on that council for the last, I don't know, maybe it was only a semester or the last year of Shane, and then I watched Bernie Cohen, whom I'd gotten to know some over the years. He was quite influential in some negotiations with me about not going to Harvard, and that helped. That was during the time when Shalala became chancellor, and he went back, good soldier that he is, he went back to being vice chancellor again. Talk about loyal service. Right. Here's this guy that's been acting chancellor, and new chancellor comes in, and she says, will you please be my vice chancellor until I get my feet on the ground? He says, oh, all right. So I have a lot of respect for Bernie Cohen also. But so I saw all three of those people be chancellor. And so it was interesting, the difference in styles. I've heard other people say this, that they thought toward the end Shane had gotten discouraged. And I saw him at a time when I think he thought the system was overwhelming the Madison campus, and that the legislature was really hard to deal with. There were a lot of budget cuts. And he just didn't, his values were good. He really believed strongly, as did Shalala. I mean, in there's some fundamentals that they both believed in. You could have a great research university that could be a great teaching institution, that could make good on its teaching commitments. But I don't think he had, at least that in that stage of his career, the notion that Bascom Hall should be an active, aggressive policymaker to fix problems. He thought it was more like diplomacy and spokesmanship and finding the right faculty to be on committees and arguing with the right legislators, finding the right formula, doing a good budget, all that kind of stuff. But I don't think he had this instinct that Shalala had, is if there's something to be done, we better get some dough. And there's only one place to get dough. You just go kind of take some from the university budget and then start working on it. And like a lot of administrators, I mean, the last thing he thought was you should increase your staff and work your people harder and make it a more centralized place. And Shalala did. So I think he had run out of steam isn't fair, but he was down about not having enough resources to know how to win the arguments. And then Cohen was interesting. He was out of the faculty, and he was a good guy. I don't remember too many things I'd want to say about the year he was acting chancellor. It was when we were searching for a chancellor, and there were some quite controversial things that he had to weather the storm on, but I don't have vivid impressions of them. But when he came back into being vice chancellor for Shalala, he was in a key position, because a lot of people were quaking in their boots. Was she going to stomp all over Madison lore and Madison faculty prerogatives and all this stuff? And I can remember literally being in his office, hearing the other end of a conversation where he was the vice chancellor and the chancellor was on the other end of the phone, and he would be saying things like, now Donna, on this one, you've just got to go to the committee. You just can't. You've got to do this one according to the book. Or Donna, you really got to talk to George first. You can't do that until you've talked to George, kind of thing. So I think he got to be an interpreter for her about what she could do and what she couldn't do. And sometimes she did whatever she wanted to do anyway. And a lot of times she was very respectful. I don't think she trampled all over faculty prerogatives, but there was enough evidence around the edges so it made an easy target for the conservative group of faculty that decided that she was, you know, the bête noire.
Yeah.
And that did happen before she left.
Yeah, I've heard it said by different people that she didn't always follow procedures, and that faculty governance, which is a sacred thing here at the university, was not always something that she was willing to go along with.
I think that Bernie deserves a lot of credit, because I think he helped domesticate her in a way to bring her into the traditions, because by the time David Ward became vice chancellor, it seems to me, I didn't hear quite so much. He did do that kind of stuff all the time. He pinch hit for her. He cleaned up after her. He smoothed out the bureaucracy for her. And he, I'm sure, had many times the same conversations. Donna, you can't do it that fast. It's going to take a little longer. Or Donna, on this one, you really have to consult the university committee or the something or other first. But on the other hand, Donna is not unconsultative. She is. Like another administrator I like very much, Pat Graham, who's the president of the Spencer Foundation and dean of Harvard Ed School, and has been many other executive things in her life. I think they're very consultative, I guess is the word, but they're in a hurry. So they consult, and then, like good executives, they make a decision. Once the decision is made, it's too late to come along, as many academics love to do and say, well, I wasn't here when you made that decision, and I don't agree with it, you know, or I missed that 6 months ago, and I won't have it, or something like that. So they're impatient with that kind of thing. So I think the pace is faster, and they expect that once a decision is made, you kind of move forward with it. And so I it's a style. I admired it, but I would freely confess that I admired it partly because I politically liked the agenda. If I didn't like the agenda politically, I wouldn't have liked the style. Because if you didn't like what she was doing, then you could go after her on cutting corners or going too fast or whatever.
We're getting near the end here. I just want to, before not open up any new topics, but the chancellor, Chancellor Shalala, was a member of EPS. She came here as a tenured member, I believe. Did she have any relationship with the department? I believe that she can come back to EPS.
She's on a 4-year leave.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second.
She could. I mean, to argue about it would have been silly because, I mean, nobody in their right mind thinks that she would come back and be a professor at the University of Wisconsin.
She is currently Secretary of Health and Social Services.
I mean, there are people that think it would be an excellent time for anybody to leave the Clinton administration, but Donna Shalala is not going to come and be a professor. And only a professor, that is, a regular practicing professor in the University of Wisconsin, so we don't need to worry about that leave. I think it was just a courtesy for us to do it. She made some nice gestures about EPS. She came and talked to us once, maybe twice, brown bags, and they were nice, they were fun. They were in the dean's conference room there, and it was the regular EPS brown bag series, maybe a little better attended than others, but still, it was just part of our regular lives. She hosted us for the annual Christmas party, which is a potluck, as usual. We brought our supper to the chancellor's house.
Western fashion.
She's actually a good neighbor, because I just live across the street from her, as you know, and unlike any other chancellor, I think, she got to know the neighbors. She had neighborhood parties.
Oh, really?
Invited the neighbors in two or three different times, picnics and so forth. And so she turned the chancellor's residence into a place that was a welcoming place, and a lot more people in the university community got invited there than had been before. I'd been here 20 years and never been inside the place until she came, and I was probably there, I don't know, 40 times in the 2 years she was here, but that's because I got all involved in all this faculty stuff. But still, she did some nice things for people that I don't think had been invited before. A lot of minority students got invited to special things there. The mentors program that she helped create, all the mentors and mentees came and so forth. So, but for EPS, she did these nominal things. I was on an oral with her, PhD oral, and she had read that dissertation.
Oh, really?
She was a very fast read. I mean, she read books in 40 minutes, and I don't mean she mastered them. I just mean that she didn't. As far as I could tell, she didn't have more than 40 minutes to give to a book. It was amazing how many books she would prep on. And so she probably gave this dissertation 40 minutes, but it was enough to make her active in the oral, PhD oral. She gave the 2 hours to the oral, and she was the sitting chancellor. Now, she didn't do a lot of that stuff, but she did enough of it so she was, not so she was saying she was a colleague, but so she was saying, I was serious when I meant that I wanted to be considered a professor of education as well as a professor of political science. So I think we should appreciate it on those grounds that she was saying, you know, I'm not going to be able to be an active member of your department. What I want to announce is that when I am a professor, I want to be known as a professor of education as well as a professor of political science. And you could easily think of someone having exactly the opposite instinct given the kind of low status of education and so forth. But it isn't low status at this university, and it wasn't low status in her career. So she did that stuff, a few orals and a few parties and a few brown bags. But she wasn't a member of the department in any other sense.
So more or less symbolic, but...
Yeah, I don't think she did any more for political science either. I mean, it was
the
same
she
stuff.
She was cross...
Yeah, she was jointly appointed in political science.
Did political science vote her for your leave as well?
I don't know. I just considered it such a non-issue, I didn't care. I just said, no, that's fine, let's move on to something important. So, she was fun to watch.
Okay, we're going to call it quits. Oh boy, we're just calling it quits in time for today.